Thank you very much, Alessia, for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me to give this talk at Perimeter Institute. I'm very happy to be there virtually again. So as you said, I'm going to talk about what happens to non-commutative space-time models when we take some non-relativistic limits, namely the Galilean and the Carolean limits. So this is some reference papers for those who want to have a deeper look at the topic later on. So the main paper is this paper here that I wrote with Angel Ballesteros, Ivan Gutierrez Sagredo, and Francisco Herranz, all of them from Burgos. So this will be the focus of the talk, but then some other interesting papers are this one here, which I wrote with Angel Ballesteros and Francisco Herranz, which is about, again, Galilean and Carolean limits, but in another kind of non-commutative space-time geometry, which is the Snyder space-time geometry, where we discuss a bit more in detail what does it mean to take these limits. So for some things, it's useful to go there. Then I would recommend a couple of more historical papers, let's say. So these two papers from the 60s, Possible Kinematics and this other one, by Lévy-Leblond and one of them together with Bakri. And these are the first papers where they Carolean limit of special relativity was defined, and they are I would say they are very nice papers. And then finally, a couple more papers, these ones that are that were written by my collaborators, where the non-commutative space-time with the cosmological constant were defined. So in one of them, there are the symmetries, and in the other one, there is the actual spacetimes. And I will make use of some of the some results that are in these papers as well during my discussion. Okay, so now that I gave you some references, let's go to the talk, to the actual talk. So what we are going to discuss today are basically different kinds of deformations of the Poincaré relativistic symmetries. And let me start here with the two deformations that are more or less well known. So let's say that in this corner we have the Poincaré symmetries. Then one way where to deform these symmetries is by introducing what a cosmological constant, which is a length scale. And this is a classical deformation of symmetries. I will give you details later. And this brings us from Poincaré symmetries to de Sitter or anti-de Sitter symmetries, depending on the sign of lambda. This kind of deformation is useful when we want to study relativity in a setting where we are looking at large space-time intervals, so that we have to include the curvature because we know that our universe has a curvature. It is not exactly the Sitter we know, but as a first approximation, it's good enough. So this kind of classical deformation is good if we want to do cosmology, for example. Another way that we can use to deform the Poincaré symmetry is something that was developed much more recently, and it is via a quantum deformation. Here in this talk, I will only talk about the kind of quantum deformation that is known as kappa deformation. There are other kinds of deformations, but this will be the one that we will focus on here. This kind of deformation is relevant if we want to look at, so I see there is a raised hand.
Yes, there is a question by Ron.
Hi, Laurent.
Hey, hello, Julia.
Hi.
Now, I wanted to let you finish first what you said about kappa, but maybe you're going to mention that in some sense kappa can be also be thought as a cosmological constant, but in moments.
Yes, so don't spoil it.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. So what I was saying is that kappa is, so this kind of, so while the lambda deformation is introduced as a relativistical invariant length scale, we can look at kappa as, at the kappa deformation as a way to introduce an energy or a momentum scale that is invariant. This brings us from the Poincaré symmetry to the so-called kappa Poincaré symmetry, and which has had a lot of relevance in some areas of quantum gravity research, especially because you can think about this kappa parameter as being linked to the Planck energy scale. As Laurent was trying to anticipate, there is some kind of duality between the sitter and the kappa Poincaré deformations of the Poincaré symmetries. In fact, we can look at the kappa Poincaré symmetries as having a curved momentum space. So the sitter has a curved space-time and of course a flat momentum space. Kappa Poincaré has a flat space-time in some sense, but as it was shown by work also by Lee, by Laurent, by myself, Giovanni Amelino Camelia, Flavio Mercati, Kowalski, Glickman, and so on, the momentum space associated to the kappa Poincaré symmetries is curved and it has a de Sitter geometry. So in some sense, we could think about this kappa parameter as a sort of cosmological constant, but in the momentum space. Now, of course, you can go beyond considering either lambda or kappa deformation, and you could think about a model where the two deformations appear together. This is, actually the problem of introducing curvatures in quantum deformed models. So introducing curvature both in momentum space and in space-time is very hard, and it hasn't been solved really. But we do have one model where we have both, and this is the so-called kappa de Sitter or kappa anti de Sitter model. So it is a kappa deformation of the Sitter symmetries. Now this is this model is very interesting. First of all, because it gives us a specific model that shows that indeed, when we consider the two deformations together, we have some non-trivial interplay effects, effects that we wouldn't have if we only had kappa or lambda. And we will see later what these are about. And this model, or in general, models that include both the quantum deformation and the classical deformations are very relevant. For example, if we want to look at probes with very high energy that travel for cosmological distances. This can be, for example, very high energy photons coming from astrophysical sources, and we want to see how their propagation along the way to come here. So if we want to see how their propagation is affected by quantum space-time properties. So it is very relevant to look at these kind of models where both kappa and lambda are present. Now, here we have seen two deformations. Now let me talk about another kind of way to depart from Poincaré symmetries. And this namely is to take a non-relativistic limit, which brings us from the Poincaré symmetries to the Galilei symmetries, which are the symmetries of Newtonian physics. So this is a limit where we are interested in small velocities. And for example, Galilei symmetries are the symmetries of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. In this setting, as I will discuss a bit more later, rather than having a mixing between time and space, as we have in special relativity, we have an absolute time that doesn't talk really to space. And we have that the light cones of special relativity open along the t equals zero axis. Of course, when we take the one of the c going to infinity limit, not of Poincaré, but for example of the sitter, so when we take this limit in a curved setting, then we get to the corresponding curved Galilean symmetries, which are called Newton Hooke spaces. And we can also take this non-relativistic limit when starting from the kappa Poincaré symmetries. And this would bring us to the kappa Galilei symmetries, which, we will discuss later. And what I just wanted to say here is that it is, of course, non-trivial to deduce how these symmetries should look like by importing what we know about the transition from classical Poincaré to classical Galilei symmetries. And then, of course, we also have kappa Newton Hooke, kappa this was already here, so I don't need to mention it again. This is the 1 over c going to zero limit. We can take another kind of non-relativistic limit of the Poincaré symmetries. And these are known as the chiral limit of special relativity. This limit was first proposed by Levi-Leblond in the 60s. This kind of limit is taken for c going to zero, even though here we have to be a bit careful because this c here is not exactly the c that appears here. I will show this better later. Anyways, the chiral limit is a limit, again, for small velocities and for large space intervals. And recently, it has gained some attention in the community because it seems to be relevant in regimes of strong gravity, and it describes the symmetries at the black hole horizon. So for this reason, in the last years, people have gone back to study this kind of geometry. And again, we can kappa deform chiral symmetries. So going to kappa chiral symmetries, we can take the curved version of these symmetries and then the kappa and curved version. So what is interesting here is that all of these points in these two squares that I draw give us an interesting opportunity to study the interplay between different parameters that are relevant in relativistic scenarios. So I have already discussed that the kappa de Sitter model allows us to study the interplay between kappa and lambda. But taking the non-relativistic limit of the quantum symmetries allows us, for example, to study the interplay between the speed of light and kappa, which is, as we will see, non-trivial. And looking at the curved versions of these non-relativistic limits allows us to study the full interplay between kappa, lambda, and c. And this is important because, so especially for the Galilei limit, very often it happens that in people start from relativistic non-commutative space-time models or quantum symmetry models, and then they just throw away the time variable if they want to take a Galilean limit. And one can wonder because this is basically what happens when you go from Poincaré to Galilei. And one may wonder if this is correct in the quantum setting. And in fact, it is not correct, as we will show. And then, we will have some surprises here as well.
Julia sorry, there are two questions.
Yeah, this is a good moment to pause.
So first Laurent and then Lee.
I have a question about, is it like this C equals zero, the Galilean or Carolian limit that you describe in space-time? What do they look like in the dual curve space? Are they also, are they like inverted? Are they, do they have the same?
Well, this is a very interesting question. So if you don't mind, I will come back to this at the end because it goes a bit... I mean, because I need some background before answer, but it is a very good question and has a non-trivial answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So yeah, thank you for asking. If I don't remember, please remind me to answer at the end. Also, Lee has raised hand.
Yes, I wonder, do you have among these limits, the limits C goes to zero and lambda goes to zero, but in such a way that the acceleration of people in Mond, like I think it's square root of one over lambda c squared.
Well, you would need to go somewhere on along the plane of these cubes, right? Rather than going along the corners. In principle, so I have not studied this, but in principle, it is something that you can do, and actually. When we will look at the, well, we will see that in some cases, actually the square root of lambda is important, not lambda only.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we will see this in a bit.
Okay, and then maybe we can come. I think it's very interesting to think about galactic dynamics and that limit.
Yeah, you mean introducing an acceleration parameter.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, let's again talk about this later. Otherwise, I will never get to the interesting part. Okay, so this was to give a bit of context and motivation for what I'm going to show in the following. And let's keep this graph in mind because it will help us get oriented in what I am going to talk about. Okay, first of all, so now we go to see in detail some of the a bit more quantitatively the things I've been mentioning. So here I'm just writing the Poincaré algebra. So this is just to fix the notation. J is rotation, P is translations, either space or time, and K is boosts. This is the well-known Poincaré algebra, and this is the Casimir. So the first kind of deformation I talked about is the de Sitter or anti-de Sitter deformation. So it's the lambda deformation. This affects only the commutator between the translation generators. So the translation generators acquire a non-zero commutator when we have lambda. And also the Casimir gets modified with this term. From the anti-de Sitter or de Sitter algebra, we get back the Poincaré algebra via a standard contraction procedure, which I mentioned here because it sets the basis also for the following contractions that we will have to do. So because there is an automorphism of this algebra, which is this one here, which is parity and time inversion, then I can rescale the P0 and PA generators by an epsilon parameter, send the parameter to zero, and then I recover the Poincaré algebra. So this should be very well known, so I don't need to say more about it. The second kind of deformation that I mentioned is the quantum deformation. So the Kappa Poincaré algebra has looks like this. So it is the only commutator that is modified with respect to the classical Poincaré algebra is the commutator between boost and translations, which usually would be proportional to P0. And here it is this more complicated expression, which of course reduces to P0 in the K to infinity limit. And this is the deformation of the Casimir. Because this is a quantum deformation and not a classical deformation, we need to go beyond the usual structure of Lie algebra and turn the algebra into an Hopf algebra. This, I'm not going to go into technical details about this. You can look at the papers and references there. But fundamentally what happens is that you need to introduce some further structure besides the commutator, and these are the so-called coproducts, which tell us whether the generators act via the usual Leibniz rule, as is the case for the P0 generator, or whether they act in a different way on products of function. And here you see that the translations, space translations and boosts do not act via the usual Leibniz rule, but act in a deformed way according to these deformations here. Now just one slightly more technical slide that tells us how to construct such a quantum deformation starting from the classical algebra. So one way to do this is to start from a so-called R matrix, whose form depends on the classical algebra you start from and has to satisfy consistency conditions given by the Young-Baxter equation. So starting from this R matrix, which as you see is a function of the generators of the classical algebra, so X, so these are the Poincaré generators. You build an additional structure that is the co-commutator, which is given by the commutator between these objects, depending on the generators and the R matrix. From the co-commutators, you read the algebraic structure of the dual Lie algebra generated by these small P0, PA, K, and J. And once you exponentiate these, so you look at the group G. So here G star is an element of the dual group, and it is given by exponentiation of this algebra here. You will see that because the dual algebra, because of the commutators of the dual algebra, I will have a non-trivial group law for these generators here. And from them, I just work out the coproducts of the algebra I showed you before. So these ones here, and then by consistency, I can work out the commutators. This is only relevant. So what we need to learn from this slide is that the fundamental ingredient to build the quantum deformation is the R matrix and the co-commutator. So when I want to do contractions, which is what I will do later, I need to look at how these objects act under the contraction, and they need to have a reasonable behavior, as we will see. So I showed you here the Kappa Poincaré algebra, and I can deform it by adding the curvature, as I mentioned, and this brings me to the kappa de Sitter or kappa anti de Sitter algebra. As you can see, is much more complicated than the kappa Poincaré algebra that I have here. And the fundamental reason is that here we are already seeing one very interesting effect of the interplay between the quantum and the classical deformation. So what happens is that when I have both kappa and lambda, I am forced to deform the rotation sector of the algebra, which is something that we didn't have in the kappa Poincaré, nor in the Poincaré, nor in the de Sitter or anti de Sitter algebras. So the interplay between kappa and lambda affects isotropy. It doesn't break isotropy, it deforms isotropy in the same way as kappa Poincaré does not break Lorentz symmetries, but deforms Lorentz symmetries. But still, it is a very interesting and unexpected effect, which we wouldn't have guessed by looking separately at the lambda or kappa deformation. And because of this deformation of isotropy, then everything else becomes quite complicated. Here, you don't really need to look at all the formulas. The main message is that there are issues with isotropy. Now let's go to do our non-relativistic contractions. First, let's do it at the classical level, which is what we already know, and to see how things work. So if I want to do the Galilean limit of Poincaré or directly of de Sitter and anti-de Sitter, what I need to do is a Ninon-Wigner contraction. So I observe that the Poincaré algebra, which is again this one, has another automorphism, which is the parity, the action of parity, which sends me P to minus P and kappa to minus kappa. So one thing that I can do is to rescale both the PA and the KA generators in this way, and rewrite the Poincaré algebra after this rescaling. This is an automorphism, as we said, so we can do it. And then take the C to infinity limit, which is the Galilean limit. What happens is that we get commutative booths, which is very well known, and we get a zero commutator between boost and the spatial translations. Also, we get a zero commutator between translation generators, even if there is a non-zero lambda. To get the Carolian limit, we have to do something similar, but exploit the other automorphism, which is the time reversal automorphism, which sends P0 to minus P0 and K to minus K. So we can rescale the P0 generator and the boost generator in this way, and then take the C going to zero limit, which is the Carolian limit.
Giulia, sorry, yes. There is a question by Florian.
Hi, Florian.
Ciao. I just have a question for the regarding the slide before.
Yes.
Just before again, I mean, the one when you deformed, this one.
Yes.
So you said that the rotations are deformed, and yes. Is there a way to see why they should be?
I mean, it's not so, so I still haven't found a way to explain this in a simple way. What happens is that you are forced to introduce this rotation term here in the R matrix in order to satisfy the consistency relations that it has to satisfy. So you have the freedom here. So here you see that there is J1 and J2. So J3 has the special role. You have some freedom to decide which one is the direction that is special. So here I chose J3 to be the three direction to be the special direction.
So usually for kappa Poincaré, there is like also a vector, right? I mean, here you take maybe the spatial kappa time.
No. So this is the usual kappa Poincaré. It's not.
Right, but there is a preferred vector, right? You could have a null-like deformation or space-like deformation.
Yeah. So I don't know what happens in that case. So this is what you get with the with the usual kappa Poincaré, but if you get the vector deformations, I don't know what happens to the rotation sector. In fact, I don't think it has been worked out.
And how unique is this type of deformation? I mean, because for Poincaré, it can be deformed many, many ways. Kappa Poincaré is one way.
So if you start from kappa Poincaré, this is unique. The only freedom you have is to pick which direction is special.
Okay.
If you want to be in the framework, I mean, if you want to do the deformation in this way, but.
Okay.
So if you start from kappa Poincaré, this is the only option.
Okay.
I don't know what happens if you start from other kinds of deformations, but I mean, still it is interesting because you're introducing this anisotropy that is not expected at all if you look at the two limits, lambda zero and k infinity separately.
And here omega is lambda square. It's not usually you often.
So square root of omega is it's here. So square root of omega is minus lambda.
Usually we see square root of lambda, but here it's actually omega is parameter is actually like okay. All right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Sure. Okay. So as I was saying, if I do the Carolian limit of the classical De Sitter or anti-De Sitter algebras, again, I get commutative boosts. So this is a very, this is the characterizing feature of the non-relativistic limits, which is that the boosts become non-commutative. And then here, instead of having k with spatial p equal to zero, I have k with the time p, so with the time translations equal to zero. And here it's just a summary of what we have just seen in the classical case. So we have that, so the rotation sector isotropy is not affected by the Galilei or Carroll limits. What is affected is the commutator between K and P0, which becomes zero for Carroll. And this is what brings us to have absolute space in the Carroll limit. On the other hand, in the Galilei limit, we have a zero commutator between boost and space translations. And this is what brings us to have absolute time in the Galilei limit. And then in both limits, we have that the boosts become commutative. The boosts commute among themselves. And this is the signal that we are in a non-relativistic non-relativistic in the sense non-special relativistic scenario. And now we are going to look at the quantum deformations and see what happens to this. Just before going there, another way to look at what I just mentioned here is to look at what happens to space-time in the Galilean Carroll limit. So I just define the homogeneous space-time of De Sitter and anti-De Sitter as the quotient between the full De Sitter and anti-De Sitter algebra with SO3 1, which is the Lorentz sector. In the same way, I can define the Galilean spacetime as the same kind of, in the same way, but now this is not the Lorentz sector, but is the boost, the Galilean boost and rotations. And for Carroll here, I have the Carroll boosts and then rotations. What is interesting to see here very quickly is that if I start from the metric in De Sitter or anti-De Sitter, so here I wrote it in embedding coordinates, which satisfy this quadratic constraint. And this is the metric on the De Sitter or anti-De Sitter manifolds coming in terms of the embedding coordinates. Then I can take either the Galilean or the Carolian limit, again, with the appropriate rescaling of the space-time of the embedding coordinates. And what happens is that I have that the metric that I had in the De Sitter becomes degenerate. And this is exactly because in Galilei, the Galilean limit, I have an absolute time. So I have one metric for time and then one metric for the for space at each point in the time foliation. And complementarily, in the Carroll limit, I have that the metric again is degenerate and splits in one metric for space and another metric that is the metric for time at each foliation, at each point in the space foliation. And for example, for Carroll, I have that space is a sphere for positive lambda and is an hyperbolic space for negative lambda. And this just comes from the fact that in the Sitter, the trajectories generated by time translation are non-compact, while the trajectories generated by space translation are compact, and the converse for anti de Sitter. Okay, so this was just a brief recap about Galilean chiral contraction of de Sitter and anti de Sitter algebras. Now we want to do the same when we have the quantum deformation. So the non-trivial thing when we want to do a contraction of a quantum algebra is that not only we have to rescale the generators of the algebra as we have done in the classical case, but we might have to also rescale the quantum deformation parameter. And in order to understand whether we need to rescale the quantum deformation parameter, we have to require that either the R matrix or the co-commutators are well behaved than in the contraction procedure. So let's see how this is done. For example, let's say that I want to take the Galilean limit of kappa Poincaré. So just importing what I did in the classical case, I rescale the generators in this way. And then I look at how the R matrix, at the form that the R matrix takes when I do this rescaling. And I see that under this rescaling, the new R matrix is well behaved in the C going to infinity limit only if the quantum deformation parameter is also rescaled in this way. However, if I do this rescaling, I get another R matrix from which I get trivial co-commutators. So if I do this rescaling at the level of the R matrix, I just get the classical Galilei algebra. I do not get a quantum deformed Galilei algebra. So this is not really what I would like. And as I mentioned, another way to do the contraction is to work directly at the level of the co-commutators. So I perform the rescaling in this way. And I see that then the contraction procedure for C going to infinity is well defined without having to rescale lambda. And in fact, gives me a non-trivial result, which is the following. So this is the kappa Galilean algebra. So this is the kappa Poincaré. I do the rescaling, and the commutators that are modified are these ones. So you see that the commutator between boost and space translation becomes much simpler than before. And then, as was happening in the classical case, I get commutative boosts. So this should be the signal that in fact I am in a non-relativistic limit. The co-products are unmodified. In a similar way, I can look at the Carolian limit of the kappa Poincaré algebra. So I start from the rescaling of the generators that I use in the classical case. I go to the R matrix and I see what happens to the R matrix under this rescaling. And then I notice that if I want to take the C going to zero limit, here this cannot be like so, but I have to modify also the quantum deform, to rescale the quantum deformation parameter in this way. And then I get the following R matrix. Using this R matrix, I find non-trivial co-commutators. So this is different from what I had in the Galilean limit. And I find the same co-commutators that I would get if I directly performed the rescaling at the level of the co-commutators with the rescaling of the kappa parameter. And in this case, this is the algebra that I get. So I get that, again, the boosts commute. Then I get this kappa deformed commutator between boost and translation. And then I get zero commutator between boost and P0. So to comment, let's go to another summary slide. So here we have the Kappa Poincaré algebra. And we see that for in the Carroll limit, as we had before, we have a zero commutator between, as we had in the classical case, sorry, we have zero commutator between boost and time translation, so that we still have an absolute space in the Carroll limit. However, and here it's the first signal of a non-trivial interplay between kappa and C. We have that the commutator between boost and the space translation is non-zero for the kappa Galilei. This would be zero for Galilei, for the Galilei algebra. So that somehow we lose the absolute time that we had in the classical Galilei case. And this in particular tells us that when we are looking at quantum algebras, quantum symmetries, and so on, we can't go to the Galilean limit just by throwing away the time coordinate and looking at non-commutative space coordinates. Because if we correctly perform the limit, we will have still a non-trivial mixing between between time and space. This doesn't happen for Carroll, but for the Galilei case, yes. And we see this also if we look at the space-time. So we know that the space-time of Kappa Poincaré is the non-commutative Kappa Minkowski space-time, which has a non-zero commutator between time and space coordinates. If we look at the corresponding non-commutative space-time for Kappa Galilei and Kappa Carroll symmetries, and this is done by rescaling the coordinates and taking the appropriate limit, we get again the same non-commutativity that we had before, which again signals that we still have a residual quantum mixing of the space and time directions that we wouldn't expect in the classical non-relativistic limits. I think I saw a raised hand, but maybe it disappeared.
Oh, you it was Florian.
Yeah, this slide answers my question.
Okay, very well. Okay, so now let's go to the full picture. So now we have kappa deformation, lambda deformation, and we want to take the Galilean limit. It is done exactly as I showed before, so I don't go into the details. I just want to discuss what happens. So in the Galilean limit, we have that the rotation sector is still deformed. So this doesn't solve so the Galilean limit doesn't take away this deformation of isotropy. Then we have the effect of the interplay between the quantum deformation and C, because we have a non-zero commutator between boost and space translations, which is very different from what we would have in the classical case. And then we see here the effect of the interplay between the three parameters, lambda, kappa, and C, because we have that now the commutator between the boosts that used to be zero in the Galilean limit is now non-zero, and is non-zero in a way that is proportional to square root of lambda over kappa. So here it's, as I was saying to Lee before, here is the first place where we see that we have non-trivial effects that are governed by the square root of lambda. In the Carolian limit of the kappa de Sitter or kappa anti de Sitter, things are a bit different. In fact, here, well, you see already that here I have much more complicated formulas than here. And this is because in the Carolian limit, isotropy is finally restored. So the C contraction cancels the effects of the interplay between lambda and kappa. So this is another effect of the interplay between the three constants. And then I see that another effect of the C contraction is that the curvature effects now only enter at the order eta square, which is lambda. So in the Galilean limit, I had the first order effects were in square root of lambda. In the Carolian limit, the first order effects are in lambda. So this is another difference. I can also look at the corresponding non-commutative space-times. So here are, this is the kappa anti-de Sitter space-time. You see that it also shows the anisotropy that we already saw at the level of the algebra of the generators. And I can take either the Galilei limit or the Carroll limit. If I take the Galilei limit, let me emphasize that I have both curvature and quantum deformation. So in the Galilei limit, I have that the commutator between space and time is again of the kind we had for Kappa Minkowski. And then the commutators between space coordinates show the anisotropy that I already talked about. On the other hand, if I take the Carroll limit with curvature, then the commutator between xa and x0, so between space and time, is no longer Kappa Minkowski, but still is non-commutative, and is the same as that I have here for the kappa anti-de Sitter or kappa de Sitter algebra. So, so here it's no longer Kappa Minkowski. On the other hand, I have that the commutator between the space coordinates are zero, and this signals that isotropy is somehow restored in this Carroll limit. Okay, so now let me go to my final slide. Oops, sorry, here something is happening. Okay, so let me go to my final slide, which is a bit of a summary of what we have learned today. So here is the kappa de Sitter or kappa anti de Sitter. So I have a finite speed of light. So I am in a relativistic setting. I have, I have curvature lambda, and I have quantum deformation kappa. As I said, we have anisotropy proportional to lambda over kappa. Then I have that the deformation, I have a deformed commutator between boost and space translations. So this is the classical piece. Then I have corrections proportional only to the quantum, due to only quantum deformation, and the correction due to the combined effect of curvature and kappa. The commutator between the boosts is only deformed if I have both lambda and kappa, otherwise it's undeformed. And the same holds for the commutator between space translations. By the way, notice that in the kappa de Sitter and kappa anti de Sitter, the boosts and the translations have a very similar behavior. There is some sort of duality there. Now, when I go to do the either Galilei or Carroll limit, I see different behaviors. So in the kappa Galilei limit, I still have the anisotropy that I had in the full case, while in the kappa Carroll in the Carroll limit, isotropy is restored. I see that when I do the Carroll limit, I consistently get that the commutator between boost and time translation is zero, signaling that again, I should be able to talk about some absolute time as I did in the classical non-quantum deformed case in the Carroll limit. When I look at the commutator between boost and space translation, things become a bit more complicated because in the Galilei limit, I have, this should be zero if I didn't have quantum corrections. And this would tell me that I have an absolute time. However, as soon as I turn on the quantum corrections, then I get non-zero terms, either only depending on 1 over kappa or depending on the square root of lambda over kappa and higher orders. Here I'm only writing what is the first order governing the corrections. So this concept of absolute time is lost in the quantum deformed Galilei limit. And then finally, I see that both for boosts and translations in the kappa Galilei case, I lose the commutativity between the boosts and between the translations, which again was an important feature of the non-relativistic limit in the classical case. In the Carroll case, I still get a zero commutator between the boosts. So this is somehow it's interesting because it seems that the Carroll limit is more similar to the classical. When we do the Carroll limit of the quantum deformed algebras, we get results that are more similar to what we had in the classical case. While when we do the Galilei limit of the quantum deformed algebras, we get results that are very different from what we would have expected by looking at the classical case. And with this slide, I finish and I thank you very much.
Thanks, Giulia, for this very interesting talk. So we now start the discussion session. And so first, are there questions from students? Okay, seems like there are no questions from students right now. So are there other questions from the other participants? Florian, you have a question?
Yeah. So here you're kind of doing the quantum version of relative locality with curvature both in, I mean, so momentum space and quantum space, right? But so you're doing the quantum boom right away, but has it been explored at the classical level, like relative locality with both curvature, momentum and configuration space?
What do you mean at the classical level?
Well, just with Poisson, I mean the system. Do you know how to work? Okay, so let me rephrase the question. So relative locality is usually introduced by putting curvature and momentum space, and yes. But usually we keep flat configuration space.
Yes.
And we have this relative locality business. And now here you have the symmetry structure, you have deformed symmetry and so on, such that you can also put curvature in space-time in a way.
Yeah.
So, and so you have a nice symmetry structure and so on. So have other people looked at what happens then for relative locality in this case? So the physics.
This is in progress. So it's not so easy to go from, so here we have the algebra of symmetries that should work in this limit. Then it's not so easy to translate this into an actual phase space picture. So it's not easy, for example, so what you do with the in the Kappa Poincaré, for example, you are able to represent the generators of the algebra on a phase space, and then you see that the momentum space is curved and the space-time is flat and so on and so forth. Here, it's not easy to do this step. So I mean, of course, we would like to go there to see what is the relative locality of this, and also what is the relative locality of the non-relativistic limits, for example. But it's work in progress, and it's non-trivial. And then one understands why people that were trying to add the curvature to both sides of the phase space were running into trouble. So even now that we actually have the algebra of one algebra of symmetries that could work, it is not so easy to work out the corresponding phase space.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And maybe here I can also link to the question that Laurent asked at the beginning about what happens to the momentum space in these limits. So we haven't done it here for the kappa deformed case. So this is again a work in progress. But we have looked at this in the Snyder non-commutative space-time. So there you know that the Snyder model can be seen as having a de Sitter or anti-de Sitter momentum space. So then you want to take there you can take the Galilei or the Carroll limit. And it turns out that when you take the Galilei limit at the level of space-time, then you need to take the Carroll limit at the level of momentum space. And when you take the Carroll limit at the level of space-time, you need to take the Galilei limit at the level of momentum space. So it's in, at least in that model, that it is much simpler than this one. There is a switch between which limit you take if you are in space-time or in momentum space. And it seems that at least in that case, when you go Galilei in space-time, you need to go Carroll in momentum space and vice versa. And that is explained in this paper that I mentioned at the very so this is explained in this paper here.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't studied the momentum space for the kappa deformed symmetries yet, so it's going to be interesting to see whether we still get this kind of feature.
Thank you. That was very beautiful. If we step back for a minute, there are several different ways to try to get at this domain of physics. And Julie, I want us to think like physicists for the moment. We can go through the algebras, and as you are mostly focusing on in this talk. But as you know, we can also go to the one particle dynamics and mm-hmm. look at free particle or the analog of relativistic particle dynamics. And if we really don't like to relax, we can try to construct the quantum field theories. And do you have any sense which will get us more insight as far as what would be relevant for experiment?
Well, I mean, as you know, we are already focusing a lot on the phenomenology of the kappa Poincaré, and
yes, this is why I ask you.
Exactly, and I think that this kappa deformation of the sitter is very promising as well. So it is much, as I was saying to Florian also, it is much more complicated to get the phenomenology from there. I think we are still at the very beginning in understanding how to do things when we are in these more complicated ways. One option, so this is, as I said, very complicated. One thing that I think is promising is to look at quantum deformed Galilei limit. because I mean, you know that we might look for effects in the laboratory, and if we want to go there, we can't really import things from the Kappa Poincaré. We really need to, the point of this talk was to show that you really need to start from the Kappa Galilei and then work out the phenomenology. You cannot just import naively the phenomenology from the Kappa Poincaré. So I think this is quite promising. But again, this is, as you said, here I showed a lot of algebra, but it's because we are just starting to explore this new space in the space of parameters, of fundamental parameters of physics. So you have to start from there, and then you can start thinking about building the phenomenon. But I think this is promising. Then I still don't know how relevant the Carroll limit is going to be. As I said, because there seems to be this duality in the limit when you do it at the level of space-time and momentum space, it might end up being more relevant than what it seems now.
If I can ask another question, do you see any way of connecting to all these new ideas about the far infrared, about soft photons or soft gravitons, which are governed by the BMS group or some extension of it?
Well, this requires a bit of more of thinking. I don't know. No, I don't have an answer on the spot to this. But I mean, it's something to think about.
Good. Okay.
Okay. So now we have an anonymous question that I'm posting on the chat, and I can read. So can we distinguish by experiments between these deformations? Is that experiment for dispersion relation or for the speed of the light?
Well, for the speed of light, yes, we have all these studies about time of flights of time of flights of particles from astrophysical sources. So there you have very high energetic particles, and we are talking about at the moment we even see neutrinos that go to the PeV or tens of PeV in energy. So they are affected by possible energy dependence in their speed. And then they travel for very long distances. So then even tiny effects accumulate. And what I find very striking is that for neutrinos of these energies, if the correction to the speed is first order in the Planck scale, then we would expect that the difference in their time of arrival with respect to low energy particles is of the order of weeks. So this was, when I first realized this, I was quite astonished, because it's something so tiny and becomes really macroscopic. So weeks, so at the moment the difficulty would be that we wouldn't be able to match these neutrinos with the corresponding low energy particles, because we would never think that they come from the same source if they come with a delay or an advance of weeks. We would think they come from different astrophysical phenomena, even though they come from the same direction. So I think this is it's very interesting. I'm looking forward to see how this is going to go.
Okay. But so are there bounds already on this possible kappa deformation?
Well, you can, so you don't put bounds on, you put bound on the first order correction, of course. Then you will need to see whether they come from this deformation or from something else. Depending on the kinds of experiments, there are bounds that are close to the quantum gravity scale. So they say that if the effect is there, should be close to the parameter, should be very close to the Planck scale. On the other hand, that are also some, I would say, intriguing for the moment analysis that do not put bounds because they have hints for an effect. So in that case, you do not put a bound. Then, okay, then we have to see if these hints, well, these are the studies both from the group in Napoli, from Giovanni Amelino Camellia, and also from a group in China by Yong Ma, and Bokyang Ma. And I mean, at least for the neutrinos, they have hints of an effect. Then we will need to see whether these are whether they hold once we get more data and we understand better the astrophysical sources and so on and so forth. But I mean,
okay, thank you.
Interesting.
Yes, looks so. So there are two more questions. Laurent first.
Hello, Julia again. I have a question about somehow going back to the phenomenology a little bit. Maybe in Kappa Poincaré, I just want to know what's the status now. I'm thinking, I mean, I know that you've been thinking and people, you know, we all have been thinking about field theory, but recently I got interested more into this observable, like the S matrix. So mm-hmm. Have people kind of tried to see whether it's possible to, you know, and you can think of the S matrix as some form of representation of, you know, Poincaré. So is there any progress of understanding what kind of deformation to S matrix elements Kappa Poincaré would give? Does that give a new clue into how to think about UV completion? It's a very open-ended question.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think it's very far away from where we are now. And with this, I mean, so now we have some control over some things, and as you know, these are simple things. And I think we are still far from understanding more complicated issues. And I mean, one of the main difficulties, as I often say, is I think we are far from understanding interactions, for example, in these models, and these. I think at the moment we should really focus on understanding interactions, because then that will also help us building a field theory and then so on and so forth. But I think our problems now are very basic.
Yeah, I was thinking about a shortcut. I know the interaction is very complicated, and it's thinking in terms of fundamental theory.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the endpoint function of this matrix as a kind of representation, you know, an element which belongs to the representation of this. Without going really into what construct the S matrix.
But you still need to be able to describe what are multiparticle states, right? Somehow.
Yeah. But does that can give us hint on how I would deform, let's say, you know, the MHV amplitudes or like amplitudes that we know? Do people mm-hmm. have? What would look the, you know, is there a natural deform? I mean, because somehow this is what you would be after, like a form of natural deformation, UV mm-hmm. completion of the of simple amplitudes. So you're saying it's not.
I think we can try to guess, but if we really want to do, really want to understand. What we are doing, I think we are still because you know, I mean, many shortcuts or many things that we, I mean, it's not that we can lift easily from what we know in the classical case when we go to this quantum case. Mm-hmm. There are many assumptions that might not work. And today I showed you one very simple case. So when you go to the Galilei case, you cannot assume that you can separate time and space as you would normally do. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, one can try to guess, but the chance that the guess is correct is very little.
Okay, thanks.
So there is now a question from a student, Hank.
Yep, hello.
Hi.
My question is, like, I've read this paper by Haldane, which proposes to describe fractional quantum Hall states by using this non-commutative space, but like it's completely non-relativistic, right? It's a condensed matter sort of scenario, but I guess it's kind of surprising to see that that kind of description shows up in the ultra-relativistic limit of this setup.
So I'm not familiar with the paper that you mentioned, so I can't really comment on that.
I guess, yeah.
I don't know if you have a more specific question.
Yeah, I guess like physically, what makes the Galilean limit look so intuitive?
Sorry, what does can you say your question again?
Yeah. What makes the Galilean limit so unintuitive, I guess?
Unintuitive.
Because you know
you mean when you are in the quantum case?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you, I mean, intuitive is what you have in the classical case because it's what you know very well and has been studied mm-hmm. for a long time and we know it. I mean, it comes from our direct experience of the world. Now in this quantum case, I think everything is very non-intuitive. So this is just one more counterintuitive feature
right.
that we are finding. I mean, we do not have intuition just because we do not have really experience of that mm-hmm. that word, I would say.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Next is Nosrat.
I had a comment on this.
Oh, okay, then Lee, go first.
Yeah, very quick comment. There is a very intuitive way of understanding those phenomena, which has been explored by condensed matter physicists. They have something like the speed of light because they have chiral edge fermions whose spectrum goes linear with the momentum. And then they put on a metric on momentum space, which is curved. So in those two aspects, they match the intuition of the simple ideas from DSR, from relative locality. And there is an interesting discussion comparing those.
I've also seen these 3D Weyl materials where you have just relativistically dispersing fermions in the bulk. Yeah, so, but
it's not the speed of light, it's the speed of sound.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
But still, they can mock up some of the phenomenology from thinking about a momentum dependent, mm-hmm. a curved metric on momentum space.
Mm-hmm. I would have expected, you know, this sort of Helding's picture to show up in the Galilean limit instead of, but yeah, that might just be.
Oh, it would be nice, but that's a different, because those are,
yeah.
it's a different limit.
Right, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay, now Nosrat.
Hello, thank you for your talk from Tehran University. I wrote my question in the chat. Is the accuracy of the experiment in the first order of the Planck length enough for distinguishing between Kapo-Poincaré and other deformations? This is also the same problem in the DSR.
No, I mean, at the first order, you can't really distinguish. At least if you look at only one experiment at the first order, so if you only look at the speed of flight, what you could do is, so you could look at how the curvature enters into the picture. So there are some preliminary studies on this. So the way you describe the first order correction, including the curvature, in the picture, this might depend on whether, for example, you are in a DSR picture or in a Lorentz breaking picture. Because some ways to introduce the curvature would break, would not be compatible with the with the full invariance of the DSR model, for example. So if you only look at flat space-time case first order correction, then I do not think that at that level you can distinguish. Unless, what you can look at, for example, is whether there are effects that depend on polarization and so on and so forth. But I think that in the flat space-time case, it's hard to distinguish. Then, when you look at how these corrections play with the curvature, then that might be possible.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Are there more questions or comments? Especially from people who didn't speak so far. Okay, so I would also have a couple of questions. So first, in your last slide, in your summary, you pointed out that somehow the Galilean, in the Galilean limit, things turns out to be different from the classical, purely classical case. So what would be your interpretation of this result and what are the implications?
Well, I mean, implications, as I said, this is the first study about this. So this is something that that we have to think about. But I mean, if indeed we cannot treat time as an independent parameter in the Galilean limit, then I would expect to see effects in the quantum mechanical description of systems, for example. Then, of course, we need to work this out. But it seems that if we introduce this quantum deformation, this quantum in the sense of quantum gravity deformations in quantum mechanics, then we would, I mean, this shows that we will need to revisit how we treat our description of time in that case.
So this could also lead to potential signatures of the Kappa deformation. If there are,
I mean possibly
they are not too much suppressed.
Exactly. I mean, it might be, but yeah, this has to be, this is to be seen.
Okay.
But I think it's a new direction to look at.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And another question that I added, so this is not super related to your talk, it's more an outlook probably. But so since with this kappa deformation, essentially you are modifying the geometry of your momentum space, what would be the implication or the modification that you would expect in the in a reorganization group flow or the Wilsonian RG in general?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I still have to understand whether so when you look at the renormalization group flow, I still have to understand whether what happens to the symmetries. So you get these some indications, for example, that you go to a lower number of dimensions in particular, if you look, for example, at the behavior of the Newton's constant and so on. And we know that also these models, for example, can be seen as models where dimension is flowing towards the Planck scale. So that might, I mean, that could be one point of contact. For example, if you have a modified geometry of the momentum space and then you want to build the two-point function, for example, in momentum space, then you see that because of the deformed geometry, you have a deformed measure so that the two-point function is affected. So maybe this could be one possible link.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, but I would like to understand whether this dimensional reduction that appears in the renormalization group flow is associated, for example, to a deformation of symmetries or what happens to symmetries, for example, in that case.
Yeah, that is also super clear to me. But thanks for answering this. Lee, you also have a raised hand.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Nobody remembers DSR2, but in DSR2, there was an overall conformal contraction wedded to a boost, which made a new representation of the Lorentz group. Anyway, if you think about that, that's relevant to connecting to the renormalization.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so are there other comments or questions? Okay, this doesn't seem to be the case. So I would ask everybody to unmute yourself to thank Julia.
Thank you.